Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker.
In July 2021, Cubans took to the streets and protested the government in a series of political actions. Lack of food and medicine and anger at the government's response to the COVID pandemic seemed to be at the center of these protests. Cuba has been a centerpiece of American policy in the Caribbean, and the communist government on the island has shown political resilience against American pressure. But these protests pose a new type of challenge to the government. They appear to be a grassroots campaign against the government, which is more experienced at confronting international threats. On today's show, we will explore the nature of these protests, the impact that they could have on the Cuban state, and how the United States has and should respond to these political developments. Our panel today is Richard Feinberg, Professor Emeritus in International Political Economy at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Open for Business, Building the New Cuban Economy. Lillian Guerra, Professor of History at the University of Florida. She is the author of Heroes, Martyrs, and Political Messiahs in Revolutionary Cuba, 1946 to 58, and is currently completing a fifth book, Patriots and Traitors in Cuba, Political Pedagogy, Rehabilitation, and Vanguard Youth. And Brian Fonseca, Director of the Jack D. Gordon Institute for Public Policy and Adjunct Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Florida International University's Stephen J. Green School of International and Public Affairs. He is the co-editor of Democracy and Security in Latin America and co-author of The New U.S. Security Agenda, Trends and Emerging Threats. Thank you all very much for joining us. Professor Feinberg, we'll start with you. We've been hearing news accounts about what's been going on in Cuba, but what exactly has been going on with these protests?
Thanks very much, Doug, for having me. Really, it's a pleasure to be on such a distinguished panel. Brian Fonseca and I have collaborated on a number of projects recently dealing with Latin America and Cuba specifically. And Lillian Guerra, of course, is a famous and very distinguished historian. And I personally have learned a great deal from her books, and I thank her for that very much. And so it's an honor to be with her. Well, there's a lot to say about what's happened over the last month in Havana. Of course, we have to say that I believe none of us have been there, unfortunately, because of a combination of travel restrictions and COVID. However, you know, we have friends on the island, we try to keep up in social media, et cetera. What we do know is that on July 11th, some tens of thousands of Cubans took to the streets in Havana, but also in provincial cities. And that was unique and important. Not that surprising if you realize that if life is difficult in Havana, it's even more difficult in the provinces. The Cuban government response, and here we can sort of debate just how harsh it was, but in the aftermath, they did arrest some 600 people or so, some of whom have been since released, some of whom are still in jail, some of whom are being given various sentences. The government response, in addition to that, initially was a harsh one, calling its followers to demonstrate that the revolution controls the streets. But then I think Diaz-Canel began to back off a bit. He and his cabinet took to TV and the media to say, look, you know, we do know life is tough here. You know, there's a lot of shortages of all sorts of food, medicine, et cetera. It's not our fault, of course, they said, by and large, it's the fault of U.S. Sanctions, but that they tried to show that they recognized some of the problems and would address them. But a big problem the government has had is that Diaz-Canel, who's been in power about 2 years, representing presumably the post-revolutionary new generation, instead of saying what people wanted to hear, which was there will be new policies for a new Cuba, instead he simply said continuismo. Like basically, I may be a little younger than Raul Castro, but I consider him my papa. And that was, you know, not well received, certainly by younger Cubans. So that produced a sense of frustration. And as a result, you know, many, many, particularly brighter, younger Cubans have been leaving the island as they are able to in the last several years and really throughout the last decade. So the opposition, on the other hand, they're in a difficult situation. Many of them have been jailed, et cetera. can they continue to mount demonstrations? Well, there was that big outburst on the 11th, but things have been pretty quiet, as far as I'm aware, on the ground since. Now, needless to say, the government is going to be less tolerant of protests in the future, probably. Now, what motivated the protests? Again, we can discuss that. Clearly, the very severe economic downturn has a lot to do with it. Some people were chanting, liberty, liberty. What exactly do they mean by that? Do they mean they want a government that removes certain restrictions, or do they want a complete overthrow of the regime? There aren't clear leaders who are articulate, who can really speak for the opposition, either on the island or in Miami. And one of the big tasks going forward, I think, for the opposition is to really try to begin to articulate, one, a vision of where they would like to go beyond liberty, and most importantly, how to get from here to there. So that's sort of where we are now.
And Lillian Guerin, two themes that Richard Feinberg highlighted here. One is, you know, economic hardship, and the conditions on the island have certainly gotten quite bad, and in particular since COVID, though this is something that's been brewing for a while. The other one I thought was particularly fascinating was this generational question, that you're talking about a new generation of Cubans that were not around during the revolution. You know, how does that interplay?
Well, in some ways, I think that we're doing Cubans a tremendous disservice by saying that they're rebelling with their stomachs. They're not. They're rebelling with their heads. Cubans, in general, have come to a consensus, not in the last year, but pretty much in the last 20 years, that they are very sick and tired of not having any control over their country's economic policy. They're tired of hearing since the early 90s, because prior to the 90s, the embargo was not an issue for the Cuban government. Fidel never mentioned it. And when he did, he mentioned it only to say that he had gotten over it, that it was no big deal, that the Soviets had provided, you know, everything that they needed, and they did it all by themselves. So the embargo was just a story that was really prominent in the public discourse in the 90s to the present. And it is the catch-all and be-all for everything that the Cuban government can't do, or that does badly, or that is unpopular. But the reality is that Cubans are very tired of not having control over government policy, and they're very tired of not having the right to say that they don't have any control. And the last 5 years have been years in which we have a new constitution that is much harsher in dictating the terms to the citizenry of what they can do. It is now a primary duty of every citizen to support socialism as defined by the Communist Party. And the Communist Party is defined as a unique, partido único, single party. You know, even in the 70s, when they had the first communist constitution, it wasn't that the constitution said, it was as if they didn't even need to say that. And now they have to say, no, this is a one-party state, and it will always be a one-party state. Then you have that coupled with a lot of policies that have shown the Cuban people that the Cuban state doesn't care about their own impoverishment. And Cubans have become precipitously impoverished since the early 90s. And that is especially true of Black Cubans. 95% of Black Cubans earn less than the equivalent of 3,000 US dollars per year, and only 58% of white Cubans earn that much. Now, the reality is that $3,000 a year is nothing, you know, and the average state salary, which is the average salary for 80% of the population, is only $30. It has been $30, regardless of changes in currency, changes in the difference between how many pesos equal a dollar. It's been the same amount in dollars for the last basically 20 years. So what am I saying about in terms of the last 5 years? So we had on the one hand, we had the fact that in 2018, the Cuban government passed Decree 349, which rolled back 20 years of rights that musicians, intellectuals, artists, and filmmakers had to create the content of their work and to distribute it and to finance it and to sell it without the interference of the government. They had to pay some taxes, but they didn't have the interference of the government. That was rolled back. And what they got instead was a regime that resembles the communist period, where the state has to be authorizing what you're doing and also has to, in fact, enable the sale. So that then brought about the first of the unprecedented protests. You had artists who were very prominent. And in fact, they are the only competition for the high economic elite that is the military or it is the highest echelons of the Communist Party and that run the state capitalist tourist hotels and facilities. So artists and filmmakers, and these people are not unknown to us. Many of them are very famous. And they came out in a series of protests that really that culminated in November of 2020 when they had a 300-person sit-in for several hours at the Ministry of Culture. And then we're told that they would be able to negotiate. And that, and ultimately that turned out to be a lie. And the Minister of Culture himself came out and created chaos by slapping a journalist and slapping his cell phone out of his hand and then creating sort of a ruckus, and people got jailed as a result. So artists were a big part of this, but there was also the fact that there's a segment of the population that is very activist around LGBTQ rights. And that was there was an attempt to co-opt that in the early 2000s by Raul Castro's daughter, Mariela Castro. Effectively, the positions that her organization takes, which is a state organization, include the one that you are not allowed, you are not authorized, as nobody else is, to self-represent LGBTQ rights. You can't go out there and make statements or hold marches or parades or say anything about gay pride unless she's sponsoring it. So in 2019, she canceled what was the government coordinated and orchestrated gay pride parade. And about 400 LGBTQ people and activists came out nonetheless, and they were arrested. And it was, in fact, when that happened, it was reported as the largest protest that had happened in Cuba since, you know, the riots of 1994, which were very short-lived and were very chaotic protests about economic conditions, also political, but short-lived. And this was very different. So we had that happening in May of 2019. We had a series of artist protests 2019, 2020. Then we had the blow up of February, where a group of very famous rap artists put words to how Cubans feel about their government and the fact that they are not allowed to disagree with it publicly and now constitutionally either. And they have no control over that. And what was that? There was this song called Patria y Vida, which is a rebuke of the 60-year long slogan of the Communist Party invented by Fidel in March of 1960, which is fatherland or death, patria y o muerte. So this is patria y vida, which is completely the opposite kind of a view. And the song generated 4 million views from Cuba, which is almost half the population, in less than 4 weeks. And that was what people were saying. People were not chanting libertad, forgive me. They were mostly chanting patria y vida, or down with a dictatorship. So there was a kind of a moment there that shook the foundations of the state, because I would argue, and with this, I'll make this as my last point, what Cubans have been doing through the internet, through their social media, through the creation of consciousness and communities that the state cannot control, what they have been doing is creating in their minds and amongst each other a future state, one in which they could control policies, where they don't have to threaten the state with overthrowing it in order to change their president, you know, or in order to have any say in what happens to them in terms of domestic economic policy. So to me, it's absurd that people want to focus so much on the US embargo, because Cubans have been talking about the internal embargo, which are those domestic policies, as primary and their greatest source of anxiety, of angst, of hunger, and of impoverishment and disempowerment for the last 20, 30 years.
Doug, if I just could add, though, in terms of methodology, in terms, Richard here, yeah, in terms of methodology, I think we do have to be a little more humble before we say we know what the Cuban people on the island are thinking and saying and are wishing. We have to be careful not to impose our own narrative on a very diverse group of people, after all, who for the most part have not been able to articulate their points of view in public. So I think a certain humility with regard to interpreting what Cubans in general.
But they haven't been, they've been saying that. They've been saying it in the rap music since 1996. They've been saying it in Facebook posts. They've been saying it in social media. There are 4 different online newspapers that interview people. We've had bloggers now for 10 years. It's not as if those voices are not diverse, certainly. But are there points of consensus? Yes. And is it a normal thing to go into any home, any street, any classroom in Havana and find that everybody there will agree that they have no power to control their government? Yeah, that's very common. And it may not make our newspapers, but if you go there four or five times a year, you know, or you have family there and you go there four or five times a year, and then you look online, it's not as if I'm imposing this or creating a narrative. The evidence is there. We just need to be aware of it and do some research on that evidence because it's overwhelming. It's very overwhelming.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. And Brian, I'm going to bring you into this conversation. And part of the really fascinating element of this has been this online presence. I've read quite a bit about the way in which Cubans' connections to the internet and increased availability of Wi-Fi seems to be having quite a bit of an impact. Could you talk about that and what this means for the development of civil society and protests?
Sure, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Doug. And again, I'm always honored to sit with Richard, and I'm very familiar with Lillian's work. And so down here in South Florida, in Miami, we're a fan of what she's doing up there at the University of Florida, just a few hours north. There's no doubt that, I mean, you're absolutely right, that there has been a surge in internet populations in Cuba with sort of access, right? Now, something to keep in mind is largely government-controlled access, which is why we have a lot of contention now about sort of the sustainability of that access to internet and sort of outside sources. I will say, though, however, that there has been a really interesting and serious sort of underground connective networking that has happened among, you know, sort of, you know, many Cubans that want to have a place to go and engage on the internet without necessarily being within the reach of the government. And so there are these underground sort of networks that are connecting communities together. You know, but again, to put it in context, it's about proportionality. And again, it's still a small part of the population that's been able to sort of leverage those. In general, larger communities have definitely aligned. I'll tell you a sort of anecdote. On the 11th, I was with my family at Universal. My wife is Cuban. My in-laws very much connected to the. We had to stop our entire Universal trip to watch protests on Facebook that were seeding into to my mother-in-law's Facebook. And so we were just sort of enamored by the amount of people that took to the streets, not just sort of, you know, one concentration, but as Richard pointed out earlier, kind of spread across the country, which no doubt made this somewhat different than what we've seen in the past. But that was very abruptly disrupted. And the government was very quick to begin to slow that communication down, disrupt that communication anyways. And part of that was to, you know, interrupt the planning and coordination of any type of sustained mobilization efforts on the streets, right? I mean, this was the government's way of interjecting and cutting off sort of the virality. I mean, at the end of the day today, in today's era, we can't wait for the little spinning circle to go for 3 or 4 minutes before we watch a video. We're sort of moving on to the next thing. And so just the slowing of the internet alone slowed down the movement of things, those images and those videos that were circulating that were often, you know, inspiring individuals to join those protests in the streets. The government did a really good job at shutting that down. And of course, members of my community in South Florida, have been sort of urging the Biden administration to pick up, or make efforts to try to, you know, get Wi-Fi in to keep that connectivity going. And again, we can talk about that later on and whether or not that's even feasible. But nonetheless, we know that connectivity has surged, but has been interrupted. Is being sort of, managed largely through, telecommunication platforms controlled by the state government, largely on Chinese technologies. As a friend of mine, Leland and Evan Ellis recently published sort of talking, you know, intimately about sort of Chinese telecommunication. I mean, Cuba's telecommunication infrastructure largely predicated on the Chinese infrastructure. But again, I emphasize, the amount of control that the government has over communication. I think that's always been a really important, element to control over the island. But these sort of interesting new connective tissue that's kind of building, kind of underground the networks that are sort of evolving. So I don't know if I kind of ranted there, but kind of give you that snapshot that communications become so vital and the ability to disrupt that is really a central, issue that we have, sort of for debate in terms of how we keep communication flowing.
Yeah, you kind of raise interesting questions about the nature of protest or the nature of discourse against the state. Lillian Guerra highlighting a number of the kind of the artistic communities and the way that that expresses opposition I imagine online communities are certainly, you know, helping to express that, but the government clearly has a great deal of power over trying to control that. Brian, you want to follow up?
No, I wanted to follow up on something, but it may take us back for just a moment, but I do want to hit on it because it was something that, both Richard and Lillian were talking about that I think is important. You know, sort of famed economist, I think, has done a tremendous job, sort of lifelong work on the economy of Cuba. Mesa Lago has sort of articulated sort of the root of some of the economic crisis in Cuba. And he sort of lays out three things that sort of led us to today, like where we're at in terms of the enormous socioeconomic strife. And so I think it's, you know, it's tough to point at one thing. I think we have to be inclusive of sort of the U.S. embargo and what that does in terms of, you know, sort of, you know, the ability of sort of the flow of, you know, economic trade between the U.S. and Cuba. But that's not the only thing. I think that's an important thing. But it's also important that, you know, to point out the centralization of the Cuban economy, which is really at the I think the key, you know, to some of the economic mismanagement. The one thing that we didn't touch on that both Richard and I have worked on collaboratively is the role of Venezuela, which had subsidized the Cuban economy. And so you got these three things that are kind of converging around COVID, by the way, which is exacerbating all of this. And so you have the central, you know, sort of ineffective central planning over the economy. You have Venezuela sort of tightening, withdrawing its ability to subsidize and continue to carry the Cuban economy to some degree. And then, of course, you have, I think, the embargo is part of that mix. And then COVID hits and it just exacerbates things even more. So I just wanted to point that up because I thought that Mesa Lago did a really good job at kind of, you know, highlighting those things that in combination, it's not one thing, but in combination, those things have created a really dire socioeconomic situation on the island that has led, in combination with sort of political repression, led to this manifestation of mobilization, which we've seen that was unlike anything we've seen in you know, you can go back to the 90s and people are arguing, even if it's a, you know, 90s was a little bit, you know, maybe less as widespread, but it was still powerful. You got to go, you know, further back to the 60s to see something of the kind of magnitude that we've seen recently.
And Richard Feinberg, on this economic question, one of the things that I'm somewhat familiar with, would love, you know, for you to speak on, is I know that there was this discussion about the possibility of the island opening a bit, in particular, some of President Obama's initiatives towards the island. It seems as though the government did the opposite and became less open, kind of more centralized, more controlled in the last few years. Is that an accurate depiction of how the Cubans have responded to some of these economic crises?
So beginning around 2011, when Raul Castro began to take the reins, he and people around him began to sort of recognize the obvious. After all, this is the 21st century. Centralized socialist planning is, how should we say, a bit passé. And they began to, you know, sort of say, okay, let's try to make our economy more efficient. Let's open up a bit. Let's allow a local private sector, although small scale. Let's invite in some foreign investment. Let's introduce some market mechanisms. And these ideas were all included in important official documents that were published. Now, these documents at the same time, however, contained language reasserting the value and the hegemony of centralized socialist planning. So I think these documents suggested the internal tension within the Cuban state, some old stalwarts saying, no, we got to stick to the old ideas. They're our best security, and they may even believe it. And then others saying, no, this is too archaic. We really need to begin to open up. And there were some important reforms that were put in place. The number of private entrepreneurs, for example, rose to the hundreds of thousands, if not more. Some foreign investment did come in. But I think it is safe to say that around 2017, 2018, the government got cold feet. It began to feel that it was losing control. And this congealed actually around the visit of Barack Obama, that I happened to be in Cuba at that time. He had a meeting with private sector entrepreneurs that, and he, you know, embraced them. And he said, this is, you know, a big part of the future of Cuba. He talked about the internet being very important. Why doesn't the government allow it more of that? he wasn't even on the airplane when the state media began to attack Barack Obama and his various ideas. And after that, the government did begin to sort of pull back. Not entirely, but the pace of change slowed and even reversed in a few areas. Now, then we had 2 years ago, as I mentioned, Diaz-Canel come in. And initially there was hope that, okay, now he would pick up the baton of reforms and even accelerate them. Instead, he did not. He did very little. So there was really a sclerosis with regard to economic reform. And, you know, so this is, goes back over 10 years. So, you know, if you were 25 years old in 2011 in Cuba, and you were hoping for, you know, fresh winds to blow into the economy, that you would have more opportunities to develop your own talents, and you saw, you know, these old guys sitting up there and going, ah, maybe yes, maybe no. Well, you know what? You tried to get your green card. You tried to get out. You weren't going to bet your youth on this sort of very hesitant pace of reform. And that was a tragedy because Cuba lost a lot of its youth, its talent, its potential leadership. And in fact, one of the reasons I think you see such sluggishness on the part of the Cuban government is that so many of the better talent over the years, but particularly in the last 10 years, have emigrated. And so the people who left, still, of course, many good people are still there, but a lot of the top talent has chosen to leave, sadly. Now, let me just finally say, okay, so there's this shock, tens of thousands of people in the streets. Again, we can debate exactly what their desires are, but clearly they're discontent. That's clear. How will the Cuban government react? And we don't know. One possibility is they just try to tighten up even more, you know, basically throw the opposition in jail. Another possibility is the reformers say to the old, to the more conservative elements, we warned you about this, we told you so, now let's really sort of get on it and try to see if we can move forward and pick up on the reforms that were promised in some of those earlier documents, but now really implement them with a full-hearted thrust forward. That remains to be seen.
Brian Fonseca, you had a response to that?
First off, Richard's absolutely right. I think it's fascinating how absolute failure it was in terms of the reforms that were articulated in 2011 in terms of the ability to implement. And again, that hesitation and forced central control, you know, undermined the ability of an entrepreneurial class to really emerge. And as he pointed out, you know, you had a few thousand entrepreneurs sort of pop up overnight. That's all gone now, for the most part. It's lost. But one of the really important things that I wanted to add is that one of the things that Cuba did, the government did, was place much of the most prominent industries into the hands of the military to run from an economic perspective. And so what the outgrowth of that was the Business Administration Group, or known as GAESA, controlled, by the way, by Raul Castro's former son-in-law, Luis Alberto Rodriguez López Calleja, who arguably may be one of the most powerful people in Cuba today. He's head of the Business Administration Group, which essentially is a series of military-owned companies that range in industries from coffee production to tourism and construction. And so many of the dominant, really, you know, heavy revenue generating industries still remain in the control of the Cuban government, vis-a-vis the Cuban military. And so the Cuban military has played a really important role in trying to be the implementer of Cuban policy in terms of, you know, sort of market orientation, and as opposed to kind of putting it exclusively in the hands of an entrepreneurial class or a private sector. And so that's how the government has maintained a lot of that control. And I think that's what's undermined many of those attempts to kind of build a flourishing, you know, market-oriented, you know, sort of economy. Just kind of build on, I think it's an important point.
And Lily and Gary, you were talking about Cubans being angry about not having control over economic decisions. And this seems seemingly what's being described here, please.
Let me give you some examples that are very, they're very concrete. In Cuba, probably the largest sector of entrepreneurs who own restaurants own pizzerias, and they don't make the kind of pizza that foreigners would like to eat. And one of the means or the levers by which the Cuban state has since, you know, pizzerias sort of exploded in number, and that has to do in part with a crackdown in 2004 and 2005 on very successful tiny little restaurants that were competing all too well for the tourist dollar and for anybody who had any income with government-owned restaurants. So then, as a result, you had the demolition of that. A lot of, more than 100 of them that I knew of in Havana and then whose names I knew disappeared in a year. And then you got the rise of this, the pizzeria. And pizzerias are a perfect place to understand how the Cuban government exercises political control through entrepreneurs and does that through mechanisms of distribution of goods necessary for entrepreneurs to operate. So if you're a pizza owner, what do you need? Primarily need flour. And the only place that you could buy flour that you could actually afford is illegally from black marketeers who are workers for the government who run government bakeries, right? So isn't that kind of crazy? That's really the flour you can afford. So you're buying it illegally from a guy who has more power than you because he runs the ration distribution center for bread and he runs the flour basically comes into these bakeries. Now, the police station knows that. Everybody in the government knows that that's happening. The only other way you could get flour is if you paid an exorbitant price for the flour, a price that we would find exorbitant, about $5 to $8 for one of these normal pound sacks of flour that you buy at a Publix for nothing, or here in Florida at a Publix, but for, you know, virtually very little, right? So that you can't afford that. And yet you are required regularly to present receipts that you have actually bought flour from these state stores that sell it at an exorbitant price. So what those kinds of policies do is two things. They create an industry in the sale of receipts from government-owned stores that sell in dollars and flour at an exorbitant price. And so people buy them who are pizzeria owners, they buy them from these guys. And then they're actually buying their flour illegally from the guys who run the ration distribution centers. So at all levels, this is a completely fake economy. You know, I mean, just that sector of it shows you how absurd it is. And so it's the way in which the state benefits from this is that if you are seen to be doing something, like if you have to go to a rally, or if you are called by your Committee for the Defense of the Revolution to go and ratify the Constitution, or you need to go vote, and you don't do those things, then the state can come to you and inspect your little restaurant, your pizzeria, and discover evidence of the fact that you've been buying your flour illegally. And then you have to not only pay a fine, but you're given a warning. You've got a detention record at the police station, probably for 24 hours. They will continue to do inspections on you. They have levers and mechanisms of control over your political voice that come from the nature of the economy. So that is something replicated in every one of these little entrepreneurial kinds of businesses that market goods to not to foreigners primarily, but to Cubans. So that's also true of beauty salons. All of the materials that you need to actually make your hair color, you get from people who work at the airport and get these things through the government for sale to government beauty salons, and they resell them on a black market basis. So again, like there are dozens and dozens of examples of that, but it speaks to the mechanisms of control over the political aspects of one's life, but also the mechanisms of control that are, as Cubans call it, based on doble moral, two completely different moralities, one which is completely fake, and it's the socialist, oh, we're so interested in people's welfare, and the other, which is the undercutting of even its open supposed embrace of licensed legal forms of capitalism. But it does come down to the ability of and capacity of the state to control distribution and resources, and then to provide these structural mechanisms of enforcement of through surveillance and through, you know, what Cubans would call blackmail, chantaje. So, you know, I think also what Richard has said is important, and it is very true that for 60 some years, the Cuban state has relied on the safety valve of exodus. And it has relied in the last 30 years on exactly what has been discussed by Richard and by Brian. And that is that you have, you know, at least two generations now of Cubans raised since 1990, or born in the late 80s and or born in the early 90s or to the present, whose entire future was premised on the idea that they would leave. You know, and that they would try to get a professional degree so they could be contracted by the government to go abroad as an engineer or a doctor, and then sink some roots down there, figure out how a capitalist, other type of democratic or what have you society works, come back to Cuba or not, but try to figure out how to get out of Cuba long term. This is not the way that a society should function, but it's one that creates a great deal of stability for the state. And it doesn't, Cubans don't have that opportunity since 2016, when Obama really changed the nature of the game and made it impossible for Cubans, or virtually impossible for Cubans, to claim the privilege that they had claimed, you know, since the 60s under the Cuban Adjustment Act, to arrive in the United States, automatically be considered a political refugee, and then within a year get a green card. That's over. And so all of this is part of the package of causes for discontent, anger, outrage, the desire to topple the state, or the desire to have a different kind of state, or the desire to at least have the attention of the world on the reality of Cuba, because it is this that complex.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We've been discussing the protests on the island of Cuba, the current political and economic state of the island, and now we'll be discussing the American response and how much American responsibility there is for the Cuban situation. Our guests are Richard Feinberg of the University of California, San Diego, Lillian Guerra of the University of Florida, and Brian Fonseca of Florida International University. So Richard Feinberg, if we can shift slightly here, but we finished the last segment talking a bit about American policy, some of the shifts under the Obama administration, and I know definitely there were some policy changes under the Trump administration. What exactly is U.S. policy towards Cuba today, and what should be changed as a way to try to respond to some of these challenges?
Okay, big question. Broadly speaking, there are sort of two camps in the United States with regard to how to deal with Cuba. There's the denial group, which has been dominant, which says, let's deny the island resources, let's try to strangle it with the hopes that somehow that will produce a political upheaval and an eruption and a destruction of the Cuban state. And that's what dominated U.S. policy for 50 years up until Obama. Obama came in and he said, well, you know, sometimes sanctions do overthrow governments, but it don't seem to be doing that in this case. So why don't we try the alternative approach, which is a policy of engagement. And there the basic idea was, look, this is a small island, 11 million people right off of our coast. We can flood the island with American visitors, with U.S. capital and international capital to the extent that it's allowed. We can flood it certainly with ideas through people, through travel, eventually through the internet. And that although we can't predict the exact time frame, and then with the change of generations within Cuba, sooner or later you would have first a gradual opening, some pluralism in the sense of a more pluralistic society. And then at some point, and we can never know exactly when this would happen, cultural pluralism and economic pluralism would finally make itself felt at the political level. Now, then Trump came in, though, and initially, actually, he didn't seem to really have a vision, but he decided, I think, for domestic political reasons, to revert back to the denial policy. And there his policies were tougher than ever, not only preventing normal commerce with a few exceptions, but really cutting off travel to a large degree, making it very difficult for Cuban Americans to send financial assistance, that is to say remittances, to their relatives on the island, and really putting the squeeze on. And then all of this happens with COVID coming in, which pretty well closes down the island to international tourism, which was by far its most important and dynamic economic sector. So this has created the severe economic conditions that we've been all commenting on. So my own view is that the Obama policy, Currently, Biden during his campaign said he would more or less revert back to the Obama policy, which, you know, was 4 years had come and gone. So, you know, some changes perhaps, but fundamentally the idea of engagement, embrace, a strategic perspective on long-term structural change, that that was the way to go. And that would certainly mean freeing up travel and remittances. But once he got into office, Biden seemingly got cold feet. And I think this had to do with two factors. And Lillian and Brian can tell us more about this from the Florida perspective. But the idea that they could carry the state of Florida by some change in Cuba policy seems to me to be a bit of a fantasy these days. But there are two congressional districts that might be flipped in the minds of some people with a harder line policy. But then I think personally, at least as important, is the fellow who chairs this Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who's the Senator Roberto Menendez from New Jersey. The reason that's important, many of your listeners may have never even heard of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But if you work for the State Department, you definitely know who the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is, because they approve all the ambassadorial appointments. And if you're a foreign service officer, professional diplomat, that's the goal in life. So you don't want to anger Robert Menendez. And he's willing to hold up other legislation as well. So I think the courtesy paid to Robert Menendez has a lot to do with the freeze on policy. So up to now, Biden's policy has not veered from what Trump had. My own view is that a lot of progress, in fact, was made during the Obama years, which was only 2 years of reform, that the private sector did grow. There was some more favorable treatment in some ways of international investment. We could talk more, maybe if we have time, about the space granted to various forms of civil society on the island, religious, artistic, intellectual, not saying it was a democratic environment, but there was space to articulate different perspectives and points of view. So in a 2-year time frame, I would say, you know, that was considerable progress, but we'll see what Biden seems to do. Biden, there were lost opportunities here, Douglas, both on the part of the Diaz-Canel government, wasting 2 years, not moving forward, not seeing the need for change, and also Biden losing 6 months. So now it's much more difficult for him, because any measures that are taken that are seen as favorable to Cuba, the Cuban government, will be harder to justify in light of events on the island. So missed opportunities.
Brian Fonseca, first of all, someone studies international relations, always wrestling with what the U.S. is going to do, what we call national interest versus global interest versus electoral interests, always ends up playing, you know, a huge role. But it also strikes me that the protests offer an opportunity for the United States to alter, you know, some of its approaches, because it seems like there's changes taking place on the island. Am I being too optimistic?
I mean, I think that this was an amazing bipartisan opportunity, right? In which I think, you know, both sides of the U.S. government could sort of agree to the fact that what the Cuban government was doing was absolutely, you know, horrendous, and that the Cuban people deserve more. I was going to point out that I happen to live in one of those districts that Richard talked about. I live in District 27, by the way. But yes, we have two congressional districts down here that were under sort of, you know, where we had elected Democrats, you know, recently, and then they flipped back to Republican, and they sort of remain very vulnerable and somewhat open. And so I definitely think that domestic politics plays into some of the policies you see coming out of the Biden administration. In fact, Biden has followed some of the same approaches that Trump took on. I mean, you saw a recent ratcheting up of sanctions, which is sort of continuity in some of, you know, former President Trump's, you know, policy approaches, which was, you know, there's a saying down here among my family in the Cuban community that at least under the Trump administration, that sanctions were a lot like, you know, sanctions for American foreign policy were a lot like Vapor's Vic Rub for Cuban grandmothers, right? You just keep slapping it on, hoping it's going to solve the problem. And, you know, so you continue to see the application of sanctions, you know, which are designed to, you know, set conditions. But beyond that, there's not a real sophisticated policy that's been articulated yet. I will say, though, one of my fellow colleagues here at the Gordon Institute was recently nominated by President Biden to serve as ambassador to the OAS, and he happens to be Cuban American, and he happens to be incredibly respected, you know, within the intellectual circles by people on both sides of the political aisle. Because of his sort of, you know, intellectual prowess around Latin America and Cuba. He served in the Department of Defense as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. So we're talking about Dr. Frank Mora. He's been recently appointed. So he's ambassador designate, and we'll see if he gets confirmation. Going back to what Richard said, unfortunately, he's got to get through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where both Menendez and our Senator Marco Rubio are probably not going to be very friendly to him during the congressional hearings or the confirmation hearings. But I mean, domestic politics, there's no doubt. And I'll tell you something that I heard recently that still has stuck with me. I was talking to a former practitioner. I will not name him, but I will cite him, but I'm attributing it to this anonymous source that I can't tell you. But he said what was really interesting, and he was in the central policymaking seat, and I won't tell you which administration because then I'll give it away. But nonetheless, what he said was really interesting. He said that Cuba is a case in which American foreign policy has gotten it wrong, but there's been very little serious ramifications for U.S. national security. And so what that means is that policymakers are going to continue to sort of favor the domestic policy outcomes over the foreign policy outcomes, because our failure in the foreign policy space just hasn't done enough damage. And I said, well, what about the Cuban Missile Crisis? That could have been catastrophic. And it was like, well, besides that, since then, you know, what has really happened outside of migration and in terms of U.S. national security? I thought that was a really interesting view into a policymaker that held a pretty prominent seat. But I say that not because I'm endorsing what he's saying. I'm saying that because I think from a Washington perspective, domestic politics plays such an important role in our foreign policy approach, to the island. And in fact, when President Trump was in office, it was very evident that Senator Marco Rubio from Florida, who had, sort of so much, kind of wrapped into his, his constituency, that he had a lot of control in the Trump administration over policy towards Cuba, Nicaragua and Venezuela as well. But because it was so important to him and his constituency in a domestic political context. Anyway, I'll throw that out there.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. And Lillian Gary, you had a response to
I want to say first that I don't know who told you this. I'm sorry if I missed that, but it seems completely amnesiac to forget that if it hadn't been for Cuba, the United States from the 1960s through the early 90s would not have supported or installed right-wing military dictatorships all over Latin America. I mean, we did not want Cuba to be prosperous. We wanted to topple the regime, and our failures at both levels, because the Soviets began supplying Cuba in the 70s through the 80s with about $4 billion a year that enabled them to have this kind of series of achievements in healthcare and in the reduction of poverty, et cetera, et cetera. So for 30 years, our failures to topple the Cuban regime then led the United States to help de-democratize Latin America at the cost of hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans' lives, and not to mention torturing and the rest of the atrocities that these regimes committed. So, that matters. I think it's only been since the early 90s that Cuba's our failure to topple the regime has had very little implication. And then, as you say, domestic politics matter the most when it comes to the symbolism that a candidate would endorse or denigrate the Cuban government. And so far, nobody has ever endorsed. I will say that what Obama did that was radically different was that he took this very unusual lead through example approach to democratization of Cuba, where he promoted, embodied the notion that he could think differently, as Cubans said, pensar diferente, which is actually one of the lines in the song Patria y Vida at the beginning, at the end. You know, the whole notion that he could go and sit next to Raul Castro and utterly disagree with him, give speeches where he said he utterly disagreed. We as a government, we as a people disagree with how you do things, et cetera. But we can be neighbors. We have paths in common. We have ways forward. This is an embodiment of pluralism that no U.S. president had ever taken. And it might have really angered all of the folks who are on the right, and perhaps, you know, Bob Menendez himself, who has been an ally to the farthest right of the Republican constituencies in Florida when it comes to Cuba, Obama might have angered them. But what he did was empower the Cuban people to see that the United States is not, that doesn't have to be the evil bad guy, the empire that wants to destroy Cuba. And that is what they have been told in very caricatured ways by Fidel, by Raul Castro, by their school system, by the media. Certainly the Escanet has returned to exactly that same discourse. So this is a kind of a position that I hope Biden has not entirely lost sight of. You know, the notion that the United States did not pass those policies under Obama saying, oh, we're doing this because we want to topple the regime. No, he's saying we want to do this because we want to create a path forward for both countries. And if Cuba decides that it wants to change its system, it will change it from within. And we can make possible the empowerment of the entrepreneurial class. We can empower people with alternative sources of information and allow them to choose to have them, for one thing, and then be able to make choices that otherwise they can't make. But you do that, he did that, at the same time that he went to Cuba and treated Raul Castro, not as a monster, but as an equal, as the head of state. And, you know, perhaps, you know, Raul wanted to take that much farther and declare himself the victor, as he did when he very famously tried to pull Obama's arm up in some kind of a, you know, I'm in charge and victory salute to who knows what, but it didn't happen. You know, I mean, Obama didn't play that game. So I personally think that the most powerful position the United States can take with respect to change anywhere is to, in fact, not try to push it and not try to say, oh, we know and we will do, we want to topple your regime. No, to actually allow the Cubans to do whatever they need to do to change their regime and to treat Cuba with respect. Now, I do think that's going to become even harder and harder to do as, you know, the Cuban government continues to detain more than 700 people that it arrested on July 11th or in the days subsequent to July 11th, the day of the protests. They're being subjected to mass trials. You know, that in general, the defense attorney in Cuba has to take an oath where he's not really defending, you know, his quote client. His first priority is to defend the revolution. And that has always been the case, at least since the early 70s. So all that is true. And it will become much harder as time goes forward if Cuba continues down the repressive route for Biden to treat, you know, with respect these people who are in charge. However, I think we can send ambassadors to Cuba. We can have ambassadors like De Laurentiis, who Obama sent. We can send somebody like the Honorable John Caulfield, who preceded him, and whose style was one not of offending or to try to create, you know, hostility, but simply toleration, civility, and pluralism. We represent pluralism in this country, and we didn't under Trump, so we need to return to that.
And Richard Feinberg, I'm going to give you the last word on this. How likely is it that we can return to this notion of pluralism and for once the kind of restraint that Obama occasionally, you know, would show in his foreign policy, that perhaps maybe it's not the U.S.'s job to change governments, but instead to simply try to be a positive influence for democracy?
Well, first, let me say, I think Lillian was extremely eloquent in laying out a critique of previous U.S. policies and a general sense of a way forward. So I thank her for that. Well, you know, when people ask me what's going to happen, I always say, well, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know the future. I can say what I think ought to happen. And what I think ought to happen is that Brian mentioned the appointment of Frank Mora. There are other people that have also been appointed to the administration, senior positions that I know feel more or less along the lines of what we've been discussing here, that a policy of just trying to hit people over the head is unlikely to, you know, evoke the sort of responses that you want. The political calculation is harder to see and the exact timing. But I think Biden's natural instincts and the instincts of people around him, you know, and I know many of them through my career, would be inclined to revert more or less back to where Obama was. That is to say, a policy of more respect, engagement, travel, openness is much more likely to produce the sort of pluralism that we want to see. Partly, of course, it the ability of Biden to move forward will depend on what happens on the island. So, you know, if Diaz-Canel takes a hardline approach, that, of course, makes it much more difficult to respond with a more forward-leaning policy. On the other hand, if the regime says, you know what, the economy really has run out of steam, we have to, you know, open it up. And they have said some things along these lines. And also, the earlier discussion that we had here mentioned some of the tougher restrictions that have been put on the intellectual and artistic sectors. That was very gratuitous. It was, I think, incredibly foolish. They could rescind some of those restrictions. After all, you know, the Cuban government over the years has actually favored, in many ways, the artistic sector. They're allowed to travel. They can keep a lot of the money they make from the sale of their artworks, etc. So to see these people as folks that you actually can have a dialogue with and work with. So in other words, I think if the government on the island opens up both in the economic area and in the cultural area, that could give more space to Biden to revert back to the Obama years.
Thank you all very much. We've been discussing the protests on Cuba, the American response to those protests, and the potential for future democratization and economic development on the island. Our guests have been Richard Feinberg, Professor Emeritus in International Political Economy at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Open for Business, Building the New Cuban Economy. Lillian Guerra, Professor of History at the University of Florida. She is the author of Heroes, Martyrs, and Political Messiahs in Revolutionary Cuba, and is currently completing the manuscript for Patriots and Traitors in Cuba, Political Pedagogy, Rehabilitation, and Vanguard Youth. And Brian Fonseca, director of the Jack D. Gordon Institute for Public Policy and adjunct professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Florida International University. He is the co-editor of Democracy and Security in Latin America and co-author of The New U.S. Security Agenda, Trends and Emerging Threats. Thank you all very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker, host, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.